what is a wicked problem? And, you know, young people in adult settings, can that be described as a wicked problem? So wicked problems were first described 10 years ago. And the definition is that these wicked problems can only be managed. They can't actually be solved. So it crossed my mind. Now we've got the two new children's hospitals. One's already well established and the other one will soon be. And children are being admitted now up to 16 years of age instead of 14 years of age. Are we still going to have this wicked problem? Are children still going to be admitted to adult settings? And I think the answer is yes, they are. Perhaps not quite as frequently, but certainly they still will be. And although the pathway I will show you was to address a problem in my own NHS board for children with urology conditions between the age of 14 and 16. At that time, the children's hospital were only taking youngsters up to 14, and the 14 to 16-year-olds needed to go into the adult wards. But I do think now we're still looking at maybe children between 14 and 18 years of age, but we also have to mention those children that are beyond 18 years of age who are still in education and are still under the care of paediatricians. And some of these young people could be up to the age of, well, into their 20s and certainly up to the age of 25. So we're talking about a broad range of young people. And there's always the counter argument that should young people beyond the age of 18 actually be going into children's settings anyway, because they have the right to have the right care by adult physicians. So I'd just like you to keep that thought in your head as I'm going through what I'm going to say. Wicked problems do need to be implemented by local stakeholders and champions. So we can't address these wicked problems unless we can get everybody on board and thinking the same way. So I thought we'd just have a quick look at what UNCRC say about the definition of a child. Well, they're quite clear. A child is a person under the age of 18. Article 3 talks about the best interests of the child. Article 12, respect for children's views. And Article 24, and I have to laugh at this, because best healthcare possible, that is a very medical representation of healthcare. And given all the conversations we've had about emotional well-being and mental health, could you just accept that for what it is, please? So what do the children's charters say? Well, we've got the European Charter for Children in Hospital, Article 8, and that's saying children should be cared for by staff who've got the right training and skills, who can respond to, you know, the multifaceted needs of children, and also that children have got the right to an age-appropriate health service. Again, Children's Charter, Article 6, would want children to be cared for with other children with the same developmental needs, and that children shouldn't be admitted to adult wards, and also that clearly separate facilities should be available for the treatment of children and adults. And very often in some areas you might get, especially in clinics, you'll get elderly people with their Zimmer frames and, you know, people in wheelchairs, and little children will be moving around because, you know, the appointments have not been clustered to the beginning of the day or the end of the day. They're sort of in general clinics, in especially in district general hospitals. And it's not fair for the adults, and it's certainly not right for the children. So we've got a lot of thinking to do. And this is the Trieste Charter that I mentioned. This was launched in Rome in 2014 at the International Palliative Care Conference. And it clearly says that, you know, children and families need to be listened to, their wishes need to be understood. Evelyn was talking about choice of place of death this morning. Again, that's all in that charter. And certainly it says about access to child-specific palliative care services. And I really do want to say, just going on a soapbox for a minute, what major inequity we've got between palliative and end-of-life services for adults and what's provided for children. For children, it's very piecemeal, very ad hoc, but adults have a right to district evening service, Mike Millan service, Marie Curie services. I'm looking at Libby over there. I know we've got Chaz Outreach. Libby, don't shoot me, but it's not enough. So again, lots more needed for children there. So what did I do about my wicked problem in NHS Ayrshire and Arran? That looks a bit busy on there. In your packs, there's three pieces of paper relating to this presentation. One shows the actual risk assessment. The other piece of paper shows an actual care pathway. And then the other piece of paper is showing you what Children's Health Scotland published, showing some joint working. So I'll just quickly go through the slides now. So again, you know, you can't do anything about a problem if you don't know what the risks, hazards, and dangers actually to the child are going to be. So you need to use some form of assessment for that risk. And we're very lucky in Scotland because of the patient safety program and all the risk paperwork we've got, every health board has got a way of assessing risk. So this is just a sample to show you. It's an adaptation of what we're using in my health board. So first of all, you need to identify the hazard and then think about, is it really a hazard or is it a risk? Who's going to be harmed? How can I mitigate the harm that might be done or avoid it altogether? But in life, you can never negate risk. There's always risk there. What you can do is minimize it. So you evaluate the risks and then you try and put control measures in place. And within the risk assessment that I've done, the risk was young people going into adult settings. If they're going on adult wards, what sort of adults are there? Are there any Schedule 1 offenders there? Is there a child protection risk there? Is the main risk that the child is going to be completely overwhelmed because of, you know, seeing sights and sounds of other people that have had interventions? You know, is that going to be traumatizing? Is the child going to have post-traumatic stress afterwards? So reviewing all those and seeing how we might minimize them. So once you've done that and you've put your controls in place, you then go back and reassess as often as necessary. The care pathway, these may be familiar to lots of people or they may not. So again, it's really about attention to the patient experience, having the right people in the right place, doing the right thing at the right time, and getting the right outcomes. On all care pathways, there's a little bit at the bottom where you record a variance. And a variance is, why did you not do something that you should have done on that care pathway? And that can be all sorts, for all sorts of reasons. And it can be used as a very good audit tool, and it can help you improve services going forward. So what happened next with me once I'd done the risk assessment and did the care pathway? Well, it did improve the facilities and the standards of care for 14 to 16-year-old boys on the urology ward. I did have some discussion with Children's Health Scotland about how this pathway might support other young people in other areas, and I'm going to embarrass Dagmar now, because Dagmar identified that the possibly would be other service providers in Scotland who may benefit from the risk assessment and the care pathway. And she put me in touch with Gerard Gagan from William Quarrier's Scottish Epilepsy Centre, who, you know, sometimes found that they were admitting younger people there. And the pathway was successfully adopted and used there. And within the pack is the article that Gerard and I contributed to that was published by Children's Health Scotland. So we did discuss risk assessments in other settings, and as I said, the pathway has been adopted by others. So in summary, I've identified a wicked problem. I've showed that there are standards, legislation, and children's charters that we should all be looking at and adhering to. I've talked about risk assessment, preventative factors, and controls that can be put in. There is a pathway that's been developed, and anybody can use it if they feel it's going to be useful to them. I'm very grateful to Children's Health Scotland for the support that they're giving, not only to clinicians like myself, but to everyone around Scotland who approaches them. They will support them with help. And obviously, I think the views of young people on services is absolutely crucial. And Thomas and Chloe, thank you very much for your contribution today. Certainly inspired me to go back to Ayrshire and get going in getting more views of children and young people on the services we provide. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Jane, thank you very much. I'm going to keep this very short because we're now going to have the parents' perspective of transition. Thank you very much, Helen.
Hello, thank you. I'm Helen, and thank you very much for inviting me here today. I feel like a bit of a fraud, so a couple of disclaimers, because I am a mum of David and Elizabeth. I'm here to talk to you about Elizabeth. My next disclaimer is, I have Elizabeth's permission to say anything I do, provided don't be embarrassing, mum. And I got her to sort out some photographs for me, so I had to sort of censor some of them to give you two or three photos. And I'm also a health professional who has actually had experience of being a mum throughout a service, which has been quite enlightening for myself in my professional life as well as my personal life. So, I was asked to speak to you for 10 minutes, and those of you who know me, that's quite a challenge. So please, I'm sure you'll give me a wee bell when I'm right. About what it was like from my perspective as a mum having a child going through transition from paediatric service to adult service. And I suppose my final disclaimer would be, if I offend anybody in the process, tough. And it is my perception, and all I'm going to do is tell you a story, because clearly I don't have any notes, so how worrying is that? So, let's see if I get this technology right. There's a wee mouse with a right click. There. So meet Elizabeth, a.k.a. Lizzie. Much to her father's disgust, because she was christened Elizabeth, to be known as Elizabeth. So here's Elizabeth, a healthy child. Elizabeth was healthy up until the age of about 13, where she was extremely healthy. She never saw a GP, she never been antibiotics, she was extremely active at school, very sporty. And what we realised through her becoming unwell was that for her, health was a very important thing. And if you weren't healthy, you weren't normal. So that was quite a learning curve for me as a mum. So I am paediatric nursing through and through. If it was a stock of rock, it would be through the middle. So clearly, I have a various viewpoint of how we should look after children in hospital when you're a child. When you hit the paediatric, that viewpoint perhaps changed slightly about how sometimes we have perceptions, professional perceptions about adult services. So anyway, Elizabeth was well until she got to the age of 13, and then she had a sudden onset of being unwell with a gastric tripe illness, where she spent about a week and a half in our local district general hospital unwell, and had spent a process of maybe about a month being very unwell. She started to recover from that, and I don't know if anybody knows who that is. Anyone know who that Jacha? I didn't know who he was either. So that is Brandon Flowers from The Killers. So that's Elizabeth at the age of 13, recovering from her first onset of being unwell as a bridesmaid at a wedding, and she came in delighted that he had asked her. It was one Devonshire Gardens in the West End, which they were staying there because they were doing a concert, and he asked her for a photograph, so she was just delighted. So she obviously filtered that one out for me to bring. But that'll give you an idea of, that was about approximately 2 weeks after her starting to get better from being really unwell, and the very next day we were heading off on holiday. We went on holiday for a fortnight, and within that period of a fortnight, now she's quite thin there, and she's not a very big, she's quite small, and she's always been quite fine, but between then and the next 2 weeks, she lost half her body weight. That gives you a bit of context about where we were. So I made a phone call and was admitted to Glasgow Sick Kids very quickly, and she became very unwell very quickly, to which we were quite in shock. It was completely out of what we expected. We didn't have a diagnosis, and she went to surgery. She was in surgery just about most of the day, and she had to have an ileostomy, which may or may not have been permanent. So we dealt with that, and then she spent a month in hospital in Sick Kids, a week of it in ITU, and another 3 to 4 weeks in Sick Kids, and we got her home, and we started that process of, she'd lost half her body weight, she wouldn't have been able to walk from here to that pillar, she was extremely weak, and we started that process of getting her better. So we got her better, and things were going fine, and she was being seen routinely by the paediatric GI team, and the whole picture of transition was mentioned. So remember, we're at the stage where we've been dealt with in clinic. She didn't require any more hospital admissions at that time. She'd kept well. And we started the transition process. And this went on. It started being talked about when she was maybe about 15. And this went on. And there was things being talked about like, you will come into clinic, and you will come into clinic, and you will sit in clinic alone without your mum. And Elizabeth said, well, I'm not doing that. I wonder where she gets that from. I'm not doing that. And I started to think about this, about what we do in paediatrics as far as transition. And we have transition as a thing that we do to people. But in actual fact, when you think about children, they transition all their lives. They transition from, you know, from being a baby to nursery to nursery to primary to primary to secondary. So they cope with transition. And we have this perception, I think, in paediatric services. And I'm not talking for everyone, obviously, but there is a perception there where this adult service is this terrible place. So we sort of talked through that, and we went through the clinic process where we started going through transition. I was to go into the room with her and sit in a corner as if it didn't really exist. Now, again, those of you that knows me, that's not really a possibility. And Elizabeth was supposed to go into the clinic setting herself, and she had to go at least twice before it was accepted that she would be ready for transition. And I'm just throwing that out there. Then what happened was she became unwell again, quickly became unwell again. And through various things that happened, I asked if I could get a second opinion. And the second opinion that was offered was another second opinion in paediatric services. Now, she was getting older. She was like 15, 16. And I said, well, no, I'd made some phone calls, spoken to some colleagues, done some research, and I wanted her to be seen at a large hospital in Glasgow where I felt the experts in adult gastric care sat. So I probably, as a parent, instigated a transition that wasn't planned for. Then, and with the best planning, then what happened was she was out, we've got agricultural background, so we're sort of, she's into young farmers. So she was out at a sober dance, no doubt, and she came in, and at the bottom of her wound, she had a very red area. So very quickly, we had to get her seen by medics. So she was still under 16. So paediatric centre was obviously her main centre of care. So she was back into the paediatric centre. She was in there for a week. And I requested, actually, there had been a plan made. But in between all of this with her care, there was a certain plan about what a maybe diagnosis was, but she didn't fit into any box and didn't have a diagnosis. So that plan didn't happen. So as a parent, I was left, and her dad was left, talking to clinicians about where do we go next? What do we do? Because there had been a plan to reverse the surgery, but all of a sudden that maybe wouldn't be happening and we didn't know. So I felt I wanted to speak to adult clinicians who perhaps had more experience in sort of adult IBD, if it was IBD. So she ended up in hospital for a week again, being treated on intravenous antibiotics, and I asked if perhaps we could ask for an adult physician to see in the hospital to see what was going on and get an appointment with one of the gastrosurgeons. So that's when we were sent over, sort of like, this was Monday, go tomorrow at 9 o'clock and see the adult surgeon in Glasgow Royal. So I had a perception in my head about what this would be like, because the perception I had was, when you go to adult services and you go to outpatients, you'll not get to go in with her. She'll have to go in herself. And people won't give you any acknowledgement of being there as her mum. And when I went to Glasgow Royal, I was very pleasantly surprised, where we sat in the waiting room and the auxiliary came out from clinic and asked us both to come in. And I was spoken to the same way I was spoken to in paediatric services. I was fully included in conversation. The surgeon did speak to Elizabeth like an adult and spoke to her continually about her plan for her care, where she thought she should go, what the plan may be. Included me, asked me if I had any questions, asked Elizabeth if she had any questions. And after the discussion, it became apparent that she felt that surgery was possibly going to be down the line, but she wanted to do some tests first. So then came the next transition of having to go into an adult ward with Elizabeth for these tests. So we went and were told to report to reception, so we did, and we went in. And the things that probably stick in my mind, because it is a few years ago now, where I sort of had the eyebrow-raising moment was, and it was small things like, I had a discussion with the ward sister, and I think she realised that actually if I didn't get in, I was going to be camping outside her doors. So I had an open discussion with her. She was quite happy for me to be with Elizabeth and sit with her all day, so that wasn't a problem. I then probably didn't have the conversation about could I go to theatre. I thought that was maybe a step too far. So I didn't have that conversation. And the other learning part for me was, here was I, a mum, who was a health professional, who was in my own environment, albeit in a different hospital, but how vulnerable I felt as a mum. And I couldn't ask that question that I normally wouldn't have been stopping myself asking. I just sat there and said nothing. So anyway, the next thing that sort of alarmed me was when Elizabeth was taken to theatre, a porter came to get her, and that was it. And a porter just took her down, and I thought, oh. So anyway, I waited till she came back, and a porter brought her back. And that, again, is a change from you go with her in paediatrics, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that was something that I thought, oh. And I found that difficult to cope with. So that was fine. She came back, and We were discharged that evening and back to the surgeon for the potential plan. So the plan indeed was you require surgery. And my advice is you need this surgery. You will have to have an ileostomy for life. And now at this point, she was 16. Now, for me as a mum, and that's back to about what I think my control is as a mum, she told me she'd a slot for theatre before Christmas. So for me, it was a no-brainer. We'll get in for surgery. What are you waiting for? Just that's. So the surgeon said to me, quote, "I'm not in the habit of dragging patients kicking and screaming for surgery." And that made me sit up and go, oh. Because in actual fact, what she was doing, what I wasn't doing, I was doing mum mode, but she was being an advocate for Elizabeth because it was about Elizabeth making the decision about whether she wanted to have this surgery. Whereas as a mum, it was a no-brainer for me. So all the emotional trauma of she's that age, she's got to make that decision. I know what the right thing should be, but I've got to allow her to make that decision for herself. So that happened. So she sat on it for 2 or 3 days with me crossing my fingers she would make the right decision, because there was no other decision. And she had to phone the surgeon secretary up and say, "I have decided I want surgery." So that happened. So she was in before Christmas and she had surgery. So then again, she's into an adult setting. And it was an adult setting where she would have to go to either high dependency or intensive care after surgery. So we go into the ward, and she was given a single room, and that was great. And I stayed with her until 11 o'clock, as late as I could, because this sister knew that I was going to be camped outside the doors, but had to go home. I did try to hide under the bed, but I got caught. So I went home. Now, mobile phones are great things, and I know we all shout at our children for being sort of attached to them all the time, but at midnight, I thought I'd done everything. I'd been there, I'd supported her, and I'd said to the staff before I'm leaving, "That's me going now. That's her. All that's going to happen now. She goes to sleep and it'll be the morning and she'll go for surgery. And I'll be back at 6 o'clock in the morning." And what happened was somebody in the night shift had come in and there was some routine test that they gave for routine bowel surgery, which Elizabeth didn't fit into. It was an enema. Didn't fit into that category. And a nurse had come in and with a pair of gloves and an enema and said, "Right." And she freaked. So she phoned me from her phone to say, "Come and pick me up. Come and get me. I'm not doing this. I'm not having this surgery. I'm not having this surgery." So after another conversation with the person in charge of the ward with me from home, we got the thing settled down. So I went back in at 6 o'clock next morning. And the surgeon came in to see her before surgery. And the surgeon turned to her and said, "Have you any questions, Elizabeth? And have you any issues apart from your mother?" So that put me in my place. So that was fine. So she had her surgery and she was in intensive care. And the intensive care nurses, she was a bit of a novelty because they'd never had a 16 and a half year old in who was attached to her phone talking to boys at 6 o'clock in the morning after surgery. And she was there for 3 or 4 days and then into high dependency and then eventually home. So She's all grown up now, so that's her now. She's now 21. And I suppose the message I would like to give is that we all have to remember that transition isn't just about for the child and the young person, it's about the family. And I was that mad woman that we all meet. I was that mad parent. I mean, I'm 10 years on, and I know I was that mad parent who people were hiding around corners saying, there she comes again. I know I was like that. And it's about that transition process isn't something we should do to people. It should be individualised, but it can be. It's about a process that should be organic, as opposed to, we're doing this to you now. My experience, and I did ask her about her experience, but my experience was very positive. I had expectations that were myth, which didn't happen. People didn't get it right all the time, but that was just about patient care. Sometimes that wasn't about transition. And I suppose I had grown up with this myth of how people, the adult services, get it wrong. And I'm probably here to say to you that there's a bit of coming and going in both services, and it's about being able to look at your individual patient to say, what do you need, and ask your patient, what do you need and what's good for you? And I'd like to say to you that everything's been very well, and she's great. She's doing her fourth year of university. However, she had a wee blip just in August, June, July, August time. She came home from the Highland Show, not well, and I had to take her into my local hospital at the age of 21. She's now fit for anything. And she's 21, and there I was, and she was very unwell, saying, I'm coming into theatre. I want to come into theatre. And I went through four different departments within the hospital, and I got into theatre because I asked, and I was there to see her going to sleep, and I was there for her coming back out of theatre, just as it would have been if she was 12, 13. So the other message is two words, and it's, you can use it as a parent, two words, just quote person-centred. That gets you lots of places. Because I think we've moved on a wee bit. And I think, you know, it's about the don't be frightened to ask and that vulnerability you feel as a mum. If you don't ask, I mean, a Ouija, if you don't ask, you don't get. And when does your wane stop being your wane? And I think that's a bit of a transition for me to realise, well, you are an adult and you can cope. Bearing in mind that she was saying, I need you there. If she was saying, I don't need you there, then maybe that'd be different. But okay, so thanks for listening.
Alan, thank you very much. Tuscany, you're up. I'll get you some water, ladies.
Good afternoon. Am I loud enough?
Yes.
Okay. So my name is Tuscany McKenzie, and I'm 19 years old. I grew up in Edinburgh, but I now live in Glasgow as a college student. So at the end of 2010, I started high school. I was 12 years old, and that was when I got the first symptoms of arthritis. But it wasn't until a year and a half later, at the age of 13, that I actually got my diagnosis. So I had pain in my feet, my knees, collarbones, my jaw, my wrists, my fingers, including my knuckles. And just to get a picture of the pain, the first thing I would feel in the morning was the pain in my knees and my feet when I woke up and got out of bed. Like the first thing I would feel at the beginning of my day was pain. And that, you know, set me up for the rest of my day, which isn't a good way to start your day. But that was my life until I started getting my treatment. So my first treatment was ibuprofen for the first 2 weeks. And then I started getting steroids for 2 months, and that led to a lot of weight gain. I then done methotrexate injections. For the first year, it was done by a nurse. And then from then on, I had to do it myself, which was very difficult for me. I'd have like a battle in my head. I have to do it, but I don't want to do it. So a year of doing it, I stopped. I couldn't be bothered doing it anymore. Injection day every Sunday was the worst day of the week for me. So I just stopped doing the treatment completely. And it worked for the first couple of months until the medication wore off. And so that was about 6 months I had no medication. And then I had to go back on the methotrexate. And it worked again, and then the same thing happened. I didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't want to do the injections anymore. So at the age of 17, I began toxilinumab as an intravenous. So I'd go to the sick kids in Edinburgh once a month for that. So when I first went to the sick kids in Edinburgh, when I first got diagnosed, I went every week for the first couple of months because the arthritis was so severe. The doctors had a lot of work to do to make me feel better. So the hospital, so after that initial period, I then went every 3 months for my reviews. And I attended lots of different appointments since being in the sick kids. I've had hydrotherapy and art therapy. That was all once a week. And then at my reviews and you know, the clinic appointments, it would be physiotherapy, the consultants, occupational therapy. And then also I went to support groups like the Children's Health Scotland one, the self-management one. So I would go, and I really enjoyed it, and it taught me about my rights as a patient in the children's hospital, and that also helped me prepare myself for adult services as well. And I enjoyed it so much, I actually wanted to help out after my first sessions. So I became a peer mentor so I could befriend and support similar young people like myself. So in the sick kids, the clinics were only open 9 to 5 on the weekdays. So when I first started going to the hospital, obviously I was only 13, I was so very young. So my mum and sometimes my stepdad, they would have to book a lot of time off work to look after me and take me to all these appointments. And I was really grateful for that. But then when I hit the age of 15, it was time for me to be a bit more independent and grow up. So my parents weaned me off their company with, you know, taking me to the hospital appointments. And whether it was their intention or not, it really helped me become more independent. I ended up having to do my own booking of my appointments, which actually is a lot easier because I can actually fit the appointments in my time, you know, with my schedule with high school and all my extracurricular activities and all that. So that was actually a big help. And then I would attend the weekly appointments alone, like art therapy, the self-management group, hydrotherapy. What also really helped was the fact that the local council gave me a bus pass. So instead of my parents having to fork out the petrol money every week and, you know, take me everywhere, I managed to take the bus by myself without any cost. So that also helped me get to all my appointments. That helped me figure out a time because I need to work out how long it would take on the bus. And that obviously helped me be independent because now I live in Glasgow. Now I need to get the bus to Edinburgh like today. So now I know the bus times, what time I should leave the house. So I'm very independent now. I can do things by myself. So at the age of 17, they were talking about transitioning to adult services. So the thing is, though, it was really easy for me because I was kind of, whether I was thinking about it or not, I was treating sick kids like the adult services by doing my own appointments, speaking to the staff without my parents having to watch over me. So it wasn't a big deal for me. And it was very stress-free for myself. So when they first mentioned adult services, they gave me a booklet explaining my condition and what to expect from adult services. But to be honest, I didn't really read it in that detail because I didn't, it just wasn't enough. I didn't think I had to do the work because I've done the work already, because I've got experience with arranging appointments, going to the appointments by myself, speaking to the staff members. So basically, yeah, I was already in adult services mentally, so I didn't really need to prepare myself physically, if that makes sense. So I used to receive my IV treatment lying on a bed in the outpatients in the sick kids, but I'd say after Christmas time, so it was like 6 months before my 18th birthday, the nurses decided to change that a bit and make me sit in a chair instead of on a hospital bed, because that's what I would expect in adult services. And I complied with it, and they were right in the end. At the adult services in Glasgow, I'd sit on a bed, so that was good preparation. And then for my 18th birthday was in July, and I wasn't going to move to Glasgow until August, at the end of August, when my lease begins. So that's when I'd wanted to move to adult services in Glasgow. I decided to wait until I moved, instead of going to Edinburgh Great Western, the Western General instead. I decided to just wait until I moved to Glasgow and stay in Sick Kids until that time, because it's actually closer for me to bus it in to Sick Kids than to take two buses to the Western General. So the plan was to move to the Glasgow Royal Infirmary at the end of August and start receiving my treatment and my appointments there. But I don't remember why, but for some reason, I didn't actually transfer until October, which meant for the first 2 months, I had to commute from Glasgow to Edinburgh and back again. Luckily, it didn't affect my timetable for college. I managed to work my way around that and make sure my appointments were on my days off, just like I did in high school, because obviously I had free periods, so I managed to make my appointments during the free periods. So I was used to problem solving and time management and all that. So when the time came, I went to Glasgow Royal Infirmary in October. The first thing I wasn't prepared for was getting my way around the building, because I never visited this hospital before. So I had to give myself extra time. I didn't know how long it would take me to walk there. So I gave myself an extra 10 minutes. I Google Maps it. It said 20 minutes. You know, I'll leave it half an hour. So I've got an extra, like, a 10-minute buffer zone in case I'm running late, I'm walking slow, or I'm getting lost. So that was the first thing. I'd never been to the hospital before, so I had to improvise a lot of things, give myself extra time to do things. And then I had to guess my way around the building. But I found it okay. And then also, unlike the Sick Kids, it's my responsibility to get involved with my college and get support from them. In the Sick Kids, they did all the work in terms of, what's the name? So they had to do all the work in terms of, like, extra support at school. Because I had arthritis in my hands, I could barely hold a pencil. And obviously that, you know, affected me in technical subjects like home economics and craft and design and all that. So the school and the hospital would work together on that, not me or my parents. So that was fine. But in the adult services, it was me that had to book appointments with the college and tell them what to do. So I was like the middleman in that situation. The hospital just left me to it, which actually worked in the end, because my college, thankfully, has a really good guidance team. So I visit them every 3 months. So when I first went to college, I told them my needs, and they gave me a lot of good support. And now every 3 months, I just update them, see how I'm doing, if the plan we've made is working, if I need any adjustments. So it's okay. I don't need the hospital's help in that aspect, because it's really easy in that way. So whether it was my parents' plan or not, I think them not going to all the appointments helped me in the end with adult services and just being an adult in general. So I have no problems arranging appointments, no problems talking to hospital staffs, no issues with arranging how to get to my appointments on time and all that. So to conclude, I would emphasize the importance of the parents when it comes to transitioning to adult services. It works for me that my parents gave me lots of support. They weren't explicit about it, but they were very subtle, you know, just saying, I can't make it to this appointment, you'll have to use your bus pass for this, or just stuff like that. So I would recommend that they teach their kids how valuable it is to be independent and responsible for their own health when it comes to, you know, arranging appointments, so that when they need to actually do it themselves for the first time, it won't feel scary. It'll feel like second nature. Because it really is, it's really not that difficult. I mean, it might be for some people, but that's why I'm saying the parents have to make an effort to really be more involved in that aspect. So their kids, I mean, fair enough, at this present time, your child might be a bit upset that you're not attending the appointment, or you don't want to book the appointment for them over the phone. But when they're my age and they're moving out of their home for the first time and they're, you know, completely independent, they'll thank you in, you know, in the end. So thank you very much.
Tuscany, thank you very much. We have about 50 minutes for questions. Are there any questions before I launch off with about 15,000 questions? I mean, Tuscany, I think it was really, you made a point very nicely that you actually started your transition journey before you left. Was that by accident or by design, do you know?
I think you'd have to ask my parents that, because it was their secret plan all along, I think.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't, I never said to them, I don't want you to take me to the hospital anymore. It was out of necessity. I mean, they have their own lives. They have, yeah. I mean, they work full time. So whether they wanted to or not, they can make all the appointments. Yeah. But I wasn't upset about it, because I realised in the end that was how it would have to go anyway. So thank you, Mum and Dad.
I mean, I guess there's no one-size-fits-all policy. In hindsight, Helen, do you think that, I mean, hindsight's a powerful and a dreadful tool. If you had your time again, would you have let Lizzie go on her own, or you'd still do exactly what you did?
So I think we live quite rural.
Right.
So we wouldn't have the luxury of ever being able to go and get in a bus.
Right.
Although now she can drive, she does her own thing, and she organises her own thing. I think the point I was trying to make was about, and you've described it beautifully, actually, that the adult service, don't get it so wrong, it's about how we deal with transition. And it's something we do to people when it should be individualised.
Yeah.
I mean, people, and I think it's about people being explicit and forgetting that children sort of are intelligent beings. And I always remember the consultant in paediatrics saying to Elizabeth at one of these pretend transition clinics, "Now, what medicines are you on?" And she said, "Is it a trick question?" And he said, "What do you mean?" Now, his ethos was he wanted her to tell him so she could prove that she knew she was taking responsibility for her health. But all she could say to him was, "You prescribe them, so you must know." It's just about, you know, it's about that expectation, I think.
Because you called it a pretend transition clinic, which I think is an interesting perspective. Because presumably they'd had this role play thing, had they?
Well, I thought it was role play, because it wasn't real for me, because it was, you must come in yourself without your parent there and prove to us you're fit for transition.
Right.
But the reality was, when you went to the adult clinic, I mean, I've got a 55-year-old husband that I think I have to go in with him.
Well, I mean, and there are young adults with learning difficulties whose parents or siblings still need to go to them.
It should be do you want to come yourself, absolutely, or do you want your mum to be with you, it's a choice.
And at the other end of the life course, there are elderly patients whose children need to go with them, which is the perfect circle of paediatrics.
Yeah.
Please. Anthony.
I just wondered what your thoughts were on having, for this transition, to have young people specific wards and services. Is that something that you think would work, or would it not work?
I think it's a good idea. However, I went to SickKids from the age of 12 to 18, I didn't see that many people my age with my illness. So I think I approve of this idea, but I think it couldn't just be for rheumatology. It would have to be more wide, so more people could be a part of it. I think it's a good idea, because we can all influence each other and be good examples for each other. I like that idea.
I think it's about people having the recognition to think about what's required. Now, in Elizabeth's case, I was quite lucky because unbeknown to me, and that whole subtle thing that goes on that you don't know whether it's planned or not, I discovered later it was planned. By chance, I thought, whenever she was in the adult hospital requiring surgery, she got a single room. Now, wasn't I very lucky? But that was all about the consultant. Because of her type of surgery, the surgeon had actually had some forethought to think, well, there's a girl of that age having difficult surgery and she needs to be in a room herself. So people had done that thinking, not by chance, so which was positive for me because they'd actually given it thought. And I think one size doesn't fit all. And in the ideal world, that would be great if it suited, but we have to ask our patients what they want, really, I think.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of when I first went to my appointment at the Sick Kids. It was the first appointment I've ever been to in the hospital before, and I was almost turning 14. And literally everyone in the outpatients and waiting room were all like little infants, and I did feel really out of place. So I'm speaking on behalf of myself, obviously, but I think a lot of other people my age could relate to that. So I think it is a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, I can reflect that. And I remember Elizabeth had been in a cubicle in Sick Kids at 2 a.m. saying, will you please get that baby next door to stop crying? Yeah. Can you put it in a cupboard, was what she said. So it just shows the mix of babies and 13, 14-year-olds doesn't always work.
Please, yeah.
Sorry, I'm just going to make a comment because I've got the mic and I've got the power. I worked with Tuscany on the self-management programme, so I do know her personally, and I would like to say thank you for that, Tuscany, because we've asked you a big favour to come along today, and I thought it was really interesting. And one thing I'll comment on is Tuscany's saying, oh, it was fine, it was easy for me, and it wasn't, Tuscany. You've been amazing, but what has been amazing to see in Tuscany is just her being empowered. And I think as adults and as healthcare professionals and whatever profession you're in, actually, it's easy to revert to trying being the fixer and try to fix all the problems when actually all the young people in this room today have shown us that they're the ones doing it and they just need that little shove and that little bit of support. And for us to say, you can do it, and for the parents to get involved and be there when you need to be there and not be there when you don't need to be there and listen to the young person. So thanks for that, Tuscany. I think that was really important in your talk, and I think everyone in this room would agree with that, and you as well, Helen. It was that was really important in your talk. It came across that you're there when Lizzie wanted you to be, but you'd step back.
Hi, I'm Dagmar. I'm also a parent of a young person who is now 27, and we had a good experience of transition too. But what I would like to know is it that we had all good transitions because we were empowered and we knew about rights? You said yourself you wouldn't have been sent away, but there would be enough parents, and particularly parents of people with learning disabilities, who would not know to speak up, who would not be brave enough to stay with their child and ask, can I take them to theatre? And I think we are speaking to the converted here, but there are too many people that don't know how they can support their young adults.
Yep. I think that was a big learning curve for me about how vulnerable, and that's the point I tried to make, was it was my comfort zone, almost. And I felt very vulnerable, and I was amazed at how vulnerable I did feel. And I think at events like this, a challenge would be, we need to get some adult colleagues along.
Oh, sorry, if I could add to that, I'll come to you in a second. I'm anticipating that there isn't any standard national way of doing this. Could I challenge the Children's Health Scotland, so just getting you started, to actually do something about this? We've got partners with the most important people here, i.e. the young people. We know that there's a need. We know that the people who probably need it more, the vulnerable, are getting less of it. It's one of the action points from today to come up with some patient-centred guidelines, some standard process for transition of care. Oh, sorry, there's a few questions here. That hand went up the most quick, probably to say it's
sorry,
already underway.
Mine's not a question, so I'll try and be really quick. It's just to say that the Scottish Government have just started funding a new project with the Scottish Youth Parliament to deal with an investigation team to help kind of review their plan for CAMHS for children to adult mental health transitions. So if anybody has any guidance on that, if you can send it over to us, and we'll make sure that the new investigation team of 10 young people can get that. And I've actually asked Tuscany if she can apply to be on the team.
So that's within the CAM setting. Perhaps it could be broadened. Sorry, you've been very patient.
Yes, thanks. I'm Tuscany's mum. I thought... Hi. Thank you.
Uh-oh, I'm scared.
No. I'm actually so proud of her because she's done such a brilliant job. And I was thinking about the time when she actually did transition from children to adults. And what was quite profound for me, and I can identify with you as the mom, but the difference is I'm not in the medical profession. So, you know, I'm just so lucky that you had a foot in the door. But I remember as a mom, what was really, really challenging for me with Tuscany was that she had to transition from going from high school in Edinburgh, going into Glasgow. So there were quite a lot of transitions that she had to go through, not just the health concerns. And I think what really, really did fantastic work was the rheumatology department, the nurses, but really Tuscany had a fantastic occupational art therapist who really didn't just help her with her medication, because that's, you know, Tuscany really, really struggled with administering her own methotrexate. But the medical profession really were fantastic. They'd come to the house and give Tuscany her injections. So the journey from the staff at Sick Kids was second to none. And now Tuscany's in Glasgow. She's flown the nest. I'm struggling with empty nest syndrome, but hey, you know. But really, you know, fantastic. So, well
thank
done,
you,
Tuscany.
Mum. Well, here's your chance to embarrass your mum. No.
I would never do that to you, Mum.
But she's paying for tea tonight.
If you're offering, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Excellent.
Gwen Garner, Children's Health Scotland. Some years ago, I thought that the right to have a patient supporter came in Scotland. What's the position now? I'm with you. I was with my 18-year-old daughter, rushed in after a car crash and went straight into A&E with her and would not be stopped. So, but she wanted me there. Right. But the patient supporter is an adult, you know, in an adult setting. Yeah. Does anybody know the answer to that? Because really, I thought you used to be able to entitled right. to have a patient supporter. Whether it was just for outpatients appointments, mm-hmm. I don't know. But right. perhaps it's worth having a look into.
Okay. Are you volunteering to do that then?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes. I think it's an ideal timing just now because we have, you know, person centredness is high up there on the agenda. And what an excuse. You can just put it under the two words, because as soon as you say, well, actually, as a patient, that's what I want, the world's your oyster. So it's a good opportunity just now. It's a good climate just now to be sort of moving this forward, I think.
May I just come in? Anyone who's expecting a baby has got a right for a birth partner. Mm-hmm. So if you use that model as well, then it should be everybody's right to have somebody there who can support them, whatever the health reason is.
So just picking up on the similar points here, I don't think any member of staff would stop someone if they asked, like you say, but most people don't know to ask. And with your guideline and the thoughts about creating a transition guideline, perhaps it should be a set of standards or a set of principles that people can then work with, because transition is going to be different for everybody. But if you can hand a document to parents and patients and say that these are your rights and potentially your responsibilities within that, then you're going to empower people. Possibly much more than a guideline that is impossible to follow and create appropriately for every single person.
Yeah. One very, very, very final point from Una.
Thanks, Steve. I'm just thinking how much we've all learnt from listening to Tuscany, and the self-management group from Children's Health Scotland has done fantastic work, but can only work with a small group of young people. And I'm just wondering if we could try with the Youth Parliament and their health group and the self-management group to look at developing some peer guidelines for other young people who don't get to go to the group, to look at how would young people think about what they might need? You've been through that, Tuscany, and I'm thinking another young person might not know what to start to practice, mm-hmm. and you've got the experience to offer that now. I remember seeing a young man who had anaphylaxis problems, and when he went on the school trip, his mum booked bed and breakfast and didn't tell him, but was just around the corner from the camp, and then went home when it was finished. And he didn't get the chance to practice what would I do if something happened, and on another occasion went out for a meal and something happened. So it just seems like such an opportunity that I'm putting the challenge back to these people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, it is now 20 past four. Many of you will be looking at your watch thinking, oh, we're almost there. So I'd like to draw that session to a close and just thank the panel very much for a cracking... For a finale. So I've got a few bits of business to do. First of all, well done, people, for your green and pink stickers. I'm really impressed to see that there were more green than pink. There's been a flurry of pink. But thank you very much for all of that. That's much appreciated. As I've mentioned, people who are wanting CPD, Gwen is your man. You've all got an evaluation form. I'm sure all of the people who've left have already completed theirs. But can you follow their example and fill yours in the next 2 minutes, please? I think most of us have organised a course, and these are really helpful when you come to the washing up after a course. So please do spend a couple of minutes, because it is very much appreciated. So now I'm just going to briefly summarise the afternoon. It's been a cracking afternoon. The first half of the afternoon was talking very much about mental health services in the community, and I think I did actually summarise that earlier on. There's nothing more powerful than an individual story. We've heard two stories this morning, and Jim gave us Connor's story earlier on. Very powerful stories that give us a lot of insight into what's happening. I think my learning points from this afternoon are that we still are some way short of getting transition right. I suspect that we'll never get it right for all people, but we can get it more right for more people. In terms of actions, I think there's potential for a standardised sort of a health needs assessment and some form of consistency for how we do the transition process, acknowledging that there's no one size fits all. Gwen's also going to do something about parent supporter. Therein ends my summarisation. It's been a cracking day. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And I'll hand you on now to Richard.
It has indeed been a cracking day, and it's getting late, and I'll be very brief. I do think some thank yous are in order. I'd first of all like to thank the Children's Health Scotland organisers of this conference. I think you'll agree they've put together a great conference with great speakers, and I'm particularly impressed by this afternoon's panel. The organising group, Liz, Dagmar, Linda, Sheila over there in the centre table, and have I missed somebody else? Dagmar, Linda... Sorry? Sylvia. Sylvia over there. Thanks. And they have delivered a great program. We've been well informed and kept engaged all day, which is no mean feat. So thank you to all the speakers. And this is probably an appropriate moment just to mention Mary Boyle. Now, Mary Boyle didn't speak today. She would have spoken on palliative care. She'd been penciled into the program early on, and she had been involved in the early planning of the program. But tragically, Mary died earlier this year, suddenly and unexpectedly. She was a tremendous professional, clinical professional, with a huge amount of knowledge. But what I really remember of Mary is her huge energy and enthusiasm. That's what we'll really miss. We already miss her and her input. She was a member of our executive committee, and she's has left a big space to be filled. Some of you may have seen her on the Kindred DVD, incidentally. So she was here in spirit and on the DVD, but not in person. I'd like to thank Steve. Where is he? Oh, he's back over there. Yeah, for doing a great job. He's kept us in order in the most gentle but firm way, and he's got a great knack of pulling the strands together, pulling out the threads that needed amplifying. It's no mean task, and I congratulate him on doing that. Lastly, to thank Bill on the AV, Linda and Danny on the